The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spragata for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Our first article by Krista Bennett DiMallo is titled, The Health Benefits of Gratitude. I'm the product of an optimist and a cynic. My mother has always seen the world through rose-colored glasses. My father viewed it with a hearty dose of skepticism. Me, I'm somewhere in between. I consider myself a positive person, but I'll always ask questions. Sure, the glass is half full, but what type of glass is it exactly? Because if it's one of those fluted styles, it might only appear full. Still, I've always been inspired by and a little envious of my mother's cheery outlook. Gratitude is just naturally a part of her life. I first witnessed it at the age of 6 when my father passed away suddenly. Instead of wallowing in the fact that she and her 2 young children had just been robbed in the worst way, she was thankful that she had us to keep our family going. As we coped with our loss, we celebrated life, marching in a Little League parade later that week and roller skating around a rink for my 7th birthday shortly after that. She took our pain and spun it into a reason to be grateful for each day thereafter. My father's untimely death taught us all how to show up fully, not to take loved ones for granted, and to never sweat the small stuff. Fast forward to 3 years ago when my mother first told me she had cancer, metastatic breast cancer. It should come as no surprise that she remained calm, reassuring, even positive as she broke the news. I, on the other hand, sobbed into the phone. And after hanging up, I did the thing you're not supposed to do. I Googled the statistics. They weren't good. Today, my mother still has cancer, but she's thriving. She doesn't look or feel sick. She exercises daily, babysits her 5 granddaughters, and has a social life that rivals mine. She has also doubled down on her gratitude practice. She starts her mornings with meditation and prayer, and looks for small moments throughout her day to pause and give thanks. My mother would literally talk to her chemotherapy pills every morning, thanking them for doing their job. And she never misses an opportunity to tell her oncologist how very grateful she is for him, and that she plans to be his patient into her 90s. She's 72 now. Despite her advanced stage at diagnosis, her tumor markers have dropped significantly from where they once were. Modern medicine gets much of the credit. In addition to chemo, my mother has undergone hormonal therapy and radiation treatments. But doctors I talk to agree that her outlook may have something to do with her good response. I see patients on the precipice of life and death, and it's those who have a sense of gratitude, purpose, and positivity about their life that get through things, says Anuradha Lala Trinidad, MD, a cardiologist who specializes in heart function failure and transplantation at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York City. It allows them to focus on the journey rather than the problem, and on what's working in their body rather than what's not. Studies show that that kind of outlook can impact the biology of your cells and how you respond to illness. Indeed, as physicians like Lala Trinidad collect anecdotal evidence on gratitude from their patients, psychologists and other researchers have been doing research to gauge exactly how gratitude benefits us both emotionally and biophysically. From imaging scans, we know that gratitude turns off neurological pathways in the brain that are associated with bitterness, indignation, hostility, and the like, says Stephen G. Post, Ph.D., director of the Center for Medical Humanities, Compassionate Care, and Bioethics at Stony Brook University. When those pathways are turned on for a significant length of time, they can negatively impact physical health. How? Over time, elevated stress hormones such as cortisol can lead to more fatty acids in the blood, increasing the risk of inflammation and cardiac problems. High cortisol levels are also linked to slower wound healing and a shrinkage of the hippocampus, a classic hallmark of Alzheimer's disease. So if you can move someone into gratitude and turn off some of those neurological pathways associated with negative emotions, you can do them a lot of good, says Post. In fact, the American Heart Association recently issued a statement in the journal Circulation suggesting that positive psychological health, which includes optimism and gratitude, can lead to improvements in risk factors for heart disease and stroke, such as less inflammation and lower cholesterol. The group also encouraged physicians to promote interventions that might improve a patient's outlook. This is exciting for doctors like myself, who often talk about the inexplicable but undeniable relationship between mind, body, and spirit, Lala Trinidad says. But you don't have to have an illness to benefit from a gratitude practice. Studies have linked it to some significant preventive health effects, too. According to researchers at the University of California, Davis, grateful people tend to have lower blood pressure than those without an active gratitude practice. Gratefulness may also lower levels of hemoglobin A1C, a glucose marker that, when high, indicates diabetes. Still, other studies have found it can help lower stress, improve mental focus, and lead to greater well-being and happiness. How do you cultivate gratitude? You can start with a simple thank you, or three. At the end of each day, think of three things that you're thankful for, says Lala Trinidad, who recommends this to her patients and does it at home with her children and husband. You can either say them out loud with your loved ones or write them in a journal. It doesn't matter if your day was lousy. Doing this really helps close it on a good note, she says. Studies have shown that even as little as 2 to 4 weeks of a gratitude practice can lead to health benefits. One published in the Journal of Health Psychology pointed to a decrease in blood pressure and improvement in sleep quality in women, while another found that gratitude letter writing led to healthier eating habits in young adults. Gratitude can clearly help make us feel well, but is it curing my mother's cancer? I admit that's a stretch. But watching my optimistic, thankful mother thrive with her disease is all the proof I need that the simple act of giving thanks can make us strong enough, both mentally and physically, to handle the good fight. For that, I am grateful. Our next article, by Sarah Stillman Berger, is titled, I Spent My 40th Sleeping Alone in an Airport, and It Was My Best Birthday Yet. It's cold and bright. I wonder if this is what it's like in prison at night. Do they ever turn the lights off? And the noise, the buzzing of fluorescent bulbs, the beeping of janitor's carts heavy with economy-sized disinfectant, the metallic crunk-crunk of ladders being hoisted, and the timed loop of announcements. There's no parking on the upper deck. All cars will be subject to towing. Every 20 minutes, I wonder, are there other people stuck here like me? And if so, if their cars are parked on the upper deck, wouldn't they just leave this place? I reposition my lightweight down jacket, now doubling as a blanket covering my shins and my torso, which is possible because I'm curled in the fetal position. Maybe the floor would be more comfortable, but comfort is the least of my problems here. I despise airport germs. Obviously, I didn't plan on sleeping in the airport for my 40th birthday weekend. I'm supposed to be celebrating the big 4-0 in Arizona with five of my best childhood girlfriends at Miraval, a spa in Arizona that costs more per day than any other trip I've ever indulged in, and one that Oprah and Gail famously visited on the Oprah Winfrey Show back in 2007. But instead of landing for a weekend of relaxing bliss, my plane was delayed while in the air, I missed my connection, and now I'm sleeping in the airport alone while icy rain pours down in sheets against the floor-to-ceiling windows. I turned 40 2 months ago. It's a big number because it means, no matter who you ask, that I'm now officially a grown-up. Even when I was 39, I had older friends that would look at me and say, "Oh, you're still a baby," when I'd mention a surprise gray hair or unwelcome wrinkle. But now that I'm 40, the baby awes have stopped. 40-year-olds are supposed to be confident, capable, and experienced problem solvers, which means missing a connecting flight should be no big deal for a smart adult woman like me. But the thing is, I haven't traveled alone in more years than there are gray hairs on my head, about 6. I'm always with my husband, and the success of our 10-year marriage has had a lot to do with teamwork. I'm good at things like planning my kids' after-school activities, getting a week's worth of groceries in under a half an hour, and making sure we never run out of toilet paper. My husband's contribution to the team, meanwhile, has always been to plan our travel. I often joke that he is my Toucan Sam, the trusty Fruit Loops mascot who says to follow your nose. He's swift and adept and can navigate any airport like a bomb-sniffing dog, and I'm not sure what my nose knows without him. Missed my connection, I texted him in a panic when the plane landed in Chicago, where I was supposed to be meeting my girlfriend for our connecting flight to Tucson, Arizona. No way, my husband responded from New York, 790 miles away. Ding, 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 with the text messages on my phone while I frantically deboarded. My toucan was already searching alternative routes so that when I talked to the gate agent, I could say, well, my husband says there's a flight to Dallas tonight that connects to Tucson. And the agent can look at me and my imaginary husband and pretend I'm not crazy while he says, let me check on that. At first, every time a text shook my phone, I felt comforted. But the more my husband tried to help me, the more conflicted I became. My emotions vacillated between, doesn't he trust I can figure this out, and holy shit, how am I going to figure this out? After all, I already knew that the flight I missed was the last one that evening from O'Hare to Tucson. Not only did I want to be with my friends, flying the friendly skies together, but I also did not want to miss a minute of my much-anticipated vacation. And more than that, I did not want to be stuck at the airport, alone. Already, I could see the stores pulling down their metal grates and closing up for the night. I imagined myself wandering the empty halls like Tom Hanks in that movie Terminal and felt a kind of nauseousness wash over me that even Dramamine couldn't fix. Driven by adrenaline and fear, I searched the floor for a friendly-looking gate agent. When I found him, I did my best impression of a 40-year-old woman, willing the lump in my throat not to erupt into 1,000 frustrated tears. My flight was delayed in the air. I missed my connection, I told him between gulps. I need to get to Tucson on the first flight out, please. He proceeded to search the computer for nearly an hour, his face changing from hopeful to disappointed every 5 minutes. Here we go, he'd say, and then, oh wait, it's full. All the while, I kept silencing my husband's calls. He was starting to stress me out even more. He knew I was talking to an agent. Didn't he have confidence in me? I understood his desire to help, but as much as he wanted to solve this problem, and as much as a part of me wanted him to solve it for me, I knew that I was on my own. Finally, I called him back. There's a flight out to Phoenix at 5 a.m. that I'm going to try to catch on standby, and then I'll just take an Uber 2 hours from there, I stated matter-of-factly. Did they at least give you a hotel voucher, my husband asked? Yes, I said, proud that I did something right, but I'm going to sleep at the airport. This detail threw him into a tailspin. It's not safe, he argued angrily. Just get a bed, he begged. Go to the hotel now. Then finally, you're being stupid, when he realized he couldn't convince me and he couldn't protect me and he couldn't fix it for me. And so, despite his vehement opposition, I stuck with my decision. By now, I was supposed to be drinking celebratory mini birthday bottles of screw-top wine in my upgraded leg space seat. Instead, I found an airport bar just as it was about to close, where the sympathetic bartender gave me Sauvignon Blanc in a plastic to-go cup, complete with a lid and a straw. I settled into Terminal B7 not far from the food court, and that's why I'm now curled into a ball on this tiny chair, sipping wine through a straw, listening to the rain and the ebbing whir of the nearby industrial vacuum working the carpet. It turns out that the airport is like a little city within itself. With the constant noises and the 24-hour McDonald's and the TVs that are always on, it never really sleeps, and neither did I. At this point, I would now likely be waking up to see the mountains, drink a green juice, and do a vinyasa flow. Instead, I got an Egg McMuffin and went to the airport bathroom to brush my teeth. As planned, I was the first person on the standby list at 4:15 a.m. However, not as planned, there was no seat for me on the flight. When the last person checked in, without a minute to spare, the gate agent looked at me and shook her head. I felt the now familiar well of panic tears. In the end, I did make it to Arizona. Did you ever doubt me? I'm a smart, capable 40-year-old woman, after all. I finally stepped foot into Miraval at 3 p.m., a day later than planned. I met my friends on their way into a body shred class, them in their adorable Lululemon tanks, me in the same hooded sweatshirt and leggings I've been wearing for the past 48 hours. So, I asked after I embraced them, feeling at last the exhausting relief that I had actually arrived. What have you guys been doing? We did a trust exercise this morning, one friend said, while the others nodded in excitement. We each had a partner and had to support each other while we walked across a cable 30 feet in the air. It was scary, said another friend, but fun. Oh, cool, I replied. Inside, of course, I was completely disappointed to have missed the experience. As they went on to their exercise class, I found my way to the juice bar and ordered some warm bone broth, which the barista gave to me in a to-go cup with a lid. As I took a sip of the healing liquid, sitting on a pillowed outdoor bench with a view of the red, snow-capped mountains, I thought back on my journey and realized I actually didn't miss a thing. It turns out I did a trust exercise too, with myself. And I'd agree, it was scary, but fun. Our next article is an interview by DeAndre Barnes about auto industry exec Joseph Anderson, who reflects on a life of leadership. A graduate of West Point, Joseph Anderson was awarded 2 Silver Stars, 5 Bronze Stars, 3 Army Commendation Medals, and 11 Air Medals during his military service in Vietnam. He went on to a successful career as an executive at General Motors before launching what became one of the largest holding companies in the automotive industry, TAG Holdings, which he continues to run as CEO. DeAndre Barnes, you were accepted into one of the most prestigious military academies in the country. When you saw that acceptance letter to West Point, how were you feeling? Joseph Anderson, well, I'd like to correct you. It's the most prestigious military academy in the United States, much more than the Naval Academy and Air Force. Laughs. I just want to make that clear on the record, DeAndre. DeAndre, sorry about that. Joseph, I thought I was going to go to the University of Kansas in engineering, and I participated in an American Legion program called Boys State, and while I went to Boys State, I got selected for Boys Nation. And when I came back from Boys Nation in Washington, D.C., West Point sent me a postcard saying, congratulations on this honor, and you're the kind of young man that we'd like to have come to West Point. They sent all 100 of us, 2 from each state, at Boys Nation. They sent me the requirements for application, and I did that. The senator from Kansas selected a principal person and then a first alternate, and I was a second alternate. And somehow the principal and first alternate didn't make it, so when I got a call from the academy in June saying, if you're still interested, show up in July, I was very excited. Part of it is it was going to be a great educational experience, and secondly, it was not going to be a financial burden on my family, my parents, and so forth. But to be quite honest, I did not have any background or understanding or appreciation for the military, as is often the case with young men coming into the academies. But you learn very quickly, and it worked for me. DeAndre, have you always known that you wanted to serve your country, or did you have another plan for your life? Joseph, I had another plan. As I said, I thought I'd go into engineering. Now, did I know any Negro, at that time Negro or African American or black engineers? No, I didn't. But with the good grades that I had, I thought that would be the appropriate experience for me, and so I anticipated doing that. I had an older brother, a lot older than me, who had been in Korea, and what I knew about him in Korea was he brought back these beautiful jackets with the dragons on the back, and so that's all I understood about the military. DeAndre, you're a highly decorated man. What was going through your mind when you received your first Medal of Honor for outstanding service in the Army? Joseph, well, when I received my Silver Star for my first big combat operation, I had been there a very short time, and I just did what I needed to do to support and protect my soldiers, my platoon. You're not thinking about a medal at the time, you're thinking about coming out of it alive. And so when I got back into base camp and was rewarded for that particular event, I was pleased. I was honored with the honor. But it was not something that you're there to do or gain or benefit from. You're there just to lead your platoon and get your folks home alive. DeAndre, in 1966, the documentary The Anderson Platoon was released to show what it was like during the Vietnam War. What persuaded you to participate in the documentary, and what did you want the outcome to be once it was released? Joseph, well, again, in the Army, things just are given to you or directed towards you, DeAndre. Coming back from that first event where I had received the Silver Star, I had a lot of visibility and a high profile. And so when this crew from France came to my organization, the 1st Cavalry Division, and my brigade, they assigned them to me. I was an African American. I was a West Pointer. I had taken French in college at West Point, and so they assigned them to me. I didn't ask for them, and quite frankly, I had some reservations about them, and that I didn't know who these three people were that were part of this film crew. And I didn't know what they would do out in the field, maybe cause trouble and get us into difficulty, making noise at the wrong time or something. That turned out to be absolutely not the case, and they became lifelong friends. In fact, I visited Pierre Schoendorfer, the producer, in France. So it was a great experience, but again, not one that I had any choice about. They said, "Lieutenant, these men are going to be assigned to your platoon, and that's the way the Army operates." As it turned out, they were world travelers and had done a variety of things in difficult circumstances. Pierre Schoendorfer himself had been captured and was a prisoner of war with the French Army in Vietnam, so he knew the country, knew the circumstances very well. He and his cameraman and sound man came to see what the Americans were doing in Vietnam, to carry that back to the French, who had been there earlier. But he did such a great job that it just took the country by storm in France. He showed it on French television in the first part of 1967. It was so well received, it showed again 3 weeks later. CBS heard about it, brought him to New York to have him narrate the documentary in English, and it was shown on the 4th of July in 1967 in the United States. The same thing happened, it just took the country by storm. It was shown again 3 weeks later, and it won both an Oscar and an Emmy in 1967. DeAndre. The automotive industry, as I understand it, has not been the best as far as being racially accepting or progressive. What was your experience like rising through your career? Joseph. I was recruited out of the Army along with an Air Force two-star general. We were recruited to bring executive leadership and operations and manufacturing into the auto industry, and so I was interviewed by both Ford and General Motors with that goal in mind on their part. I made the decision to go with General Motors and started out with Pontiac Motor Division and manufacturing, again leading people. The auto industry has been a source of employment for minorities, for African Americans, for many, many generations coming out of the South. When I came in the late 70s, early 80s, we were the first African American individuals in the executive group in manufacturing and operations. Of course, subsequent to that time, there have been a number of other high-level African-American men and women in a variety of positions, and they've had African-Americans on the board of directors. So from where they were, they've come a long way. Are they where they can be and should be? Not until there is an African-American chairman of the board or an African-American CEO. Then we'll know we've arrived. DeAndre, can you tell me how TAG Holdings, the company you run as CEO, came to be? Joseph. Well, when I bought my first company in 1994 after leaving General Motors, I went with a gentleman for a couple of months and then decided to do it on my own. TAG Holdings, standing for the Anderson Group, was the organizational structure that I created. As I would acquire companies, they would be under TAG Holdings. Over the course of the years, I've bought and been majority owner of about 15 different companies, and they come and go in terms of me owning them and then selling them. DeAndre. What would you say is the most challenging part about being an African-American CEO, especially with the social justice climate we're going through today? Joseph. I find it challenging because the social justice issues are real. Every single day of my life, I wake up, I'm a black man in America, and there's no two ways about that, and those realities face us. You watch the news every night, and you see the issues that are going on, and it's challenging to say the least. Nonetheless, in terms of the things that I do every day, operating my businesses, mentoring young men and women who ask how they can do what I do, serving on boards like the Federal Reserve Bank Board, those are all activities and responsibilities that I have assumed in spite of some of the issues and challenges that still exist about race in this country. DeAndre, what's the future for companies like yours as the industry consolidates brands and platforms, creates more global conglomerates, and shifts to simpler electric vehicles with fewer parts? Joseph. I think in this era right now, the automobile industry is doing its thing relative to electric vehicles and so forth, and that is not going to go away anytime soon. So the challenge for companies like mine is to stay current and get ahead of the technology and innovation that's required to be competitive. But additionally, companies like mine, which are minority certified and veteran-owned certified, have the opportunity in this environment of diversity and inclusion to grow with the auto companies and with other industries also. DeAndre, you're a successful African-American man who drives nice cars. Have you ever felt that people, especially police officers, felt you didn't belong in those cars because of your skin color? Joseph, in this calendar year, I've had two incidents. One, I was doing a little bit over the speed limit, I won't say how much, but a female police officer pulled me over and told me how fast I was going, and she went back to her car and did her thing and came back and said, "Okay, I'm just going to give you a warning because it was your birthday last week." And so what can I say except she treated me very nicely. I was stopped another time. I was driving my Escalade and he pulled me over and said, "You did a rolling stop with the traffic light." I said, "Well, officer, nobody's around and I was just turning right." He did give me a ticket. So I guess that was a big deal, a black man in an Escalade not stopping the vehicle fully. Should I stop fully? Obviously. Is that something that everybody gets stopped for? I don't know. But these are the kinds of issues and challenges that clearly come into your mind when driving while black. DeAndre, you say you've personally experienced few instances of overt racism, but you lived through the civil rights movement. Does America seem more inclusive today than it did in the 60s, or do the problems look the same now as then? Joseph, in terms of today's environment as an African American as compared to the past, clearly individuals like myself who are business owners, there are more and more of us, and African Americans who are serving on public boards, those numbers have increased dramatically. There was a network of African Americans who collaborated together called the Executive Leadership Council, which was formed to help us mentor each other on how to be senior executives in major corporations. Subsequent to that, there was an organization formed called the Black Corporate Directors Conference, and that was put together to help us mentor each other on how to serve on boards. But there's no question that there is still a gap in terms of those who are having those kinds of successes, and the mass is a majority of African Americans with lower incomes and levels of homeownership. All those things are dramatically behind the average for the country as a whole, so we've still got a lot of work to do. There's been some progress, without question, but there's still a lot of work left to do. DeAndre, my final question is, what advice do you have for the next generation of black entrepreneurs? Joseph, the recommendation that I have for the next generation of entrepreneurs is learn from those of us who are already here. We've made mistakes, some of us have survived and learned from those lessons. Use that as a starting point and be very focused on strategic perspectives that exist in the marketplace and industry and so forth. And don't focus on where others have been. Identify the opportunities in the future. Engage and create a circumstance for yourself. Opportunities are going to open up because the marketplace likes winners. They like success. And yes, there are more challenges, but on the other hand, winners are winners, and the marketplace will support winners. Our next article by Alina Nicolou is titled, Danielle Steele just published her 185th novel, Spy, and has no plans of slowing down. The events of Danielle Steele's life read like a modern-day fairy tale, or perhaps they read like the plot of one of her own best-selling books, sagas about ordinary people whose lives turn sharply in the direction of adventure. Like many of her characters, Steele has lived an extraordinary life. She holds the honor of being the best-selling author alive. Her books, all still written via typewriter, have sold a combined 800 million copies. She is what so few authors are these days. A veritable celebrity. Yet despite the kind of success that means she could have retired long ago, Steele still chugs on undeterred. Releasing an average of 7 books every year, the author writes so prolifically that even she sometimes forgets what her latest book is about. That's not the case, however, with Spy, her most recent work. It follows an elegant young woman who's recruited into British intelligence during World War II. Spy's Alexandra Wickham was directly inspired by friends of Steele's in France who recently discovered their mothers and grandmothers were actually spies during the war. They had the appearance of these nice little bourgeois ladies when they actually did life-threatening missions throughout the entire war, Steele tells OprahMag.com. Unlike Alexandra, however, the details of Steele's own life are far from secret, made public through the years by various essays, articles, and interviews, plus her book sales, which clearly spell out her success. And her domestic life is just as headline-grabbing as her writing career. Steele sustained a pace of writing at least 4 books every year while raising 9 children, which she had between 2 husbands. Many of Steele's children didn't even realize their mom was a famous writer until they got to college. "We never talked about it. It was a taboo subject," says Steele. Instead, she relished the sitcom-worthy rough-and-tumble life of raising a brood, recalling moments like the time one of her sons brought a remote-control fart machine to church. "I thought it was hysterically funny, which you're not supposed to encourage," she remembers. Though all but one of her children had moved out of the house, Steele is still very involved in her kids' lives, often flying around the world to visit them, and on call for dog sitter duty. But this extraordinary life, sustained by her literary success, was never part of Steele's plan. The plan, according to a 19-year-old Steele, was to become a fashion designer. Then, while she was studying at Parsons, the aspiring designer was given a typewriter, and the novels poured out, nearly 200 of them to date, in fact. The way Steele speaks about her writing ability makes it sound mystical, the byproduct of an enchantment. "I don't know where it comes from, it just appears," Steele says. On her blog, Steele describes the writing process as a movie she watches as she writes. "I last 2 weeks at most without writing, and then I think, oh my God, it's gone. I have to chase it and make sure I can still do it." It's tempting to speak of Steele's life using the vocabulary of a fairy tale. She's Cinderella, but instead of a prince, she got writing superstardom, houses in San Francisco and Paris, and an enviable wardrobe. But Steele didn't reach this pinnacle thanks to the wave of a magic wand. She got there thanks to a grueling crime that's required unfathomably hard work. After her first book, Steele's next 5 books didn't sell, but the 6th one did. "I always say to young people who are writing, if I had quit after 3, I wouldn't have the career I have today," Steele says. She adds that as much as her jet-setting life seems glamorous, there's also an isolation that accompanies literary fame. In a candid conversation, Steele opens up to OprahMag.com about writing 185 books, raising 9 kids, and online shopping at Zara at 4 in the morning. People often think of writing novels as a dream job, but is writing a dream job? I don't think any job is a dream job. That's a delusion, and that's true of motherhood or marriage and relationships. It's true of anything. Think of things you've done and gone through. It's not fun every day. It's not easy every day. I think a lot of people don't want to stick with a job like that. But I got hooked on writing books. I love it. Now it's my dream job. I can't think of another job I'd enjoy as much. Writing books makes you more interested in people's problems because we all have those problems. It doesn't matter who you are. You're subject to the same worries and problems and illnesses and losses. So you don't just draw on your own problems, you're listening to others as well. Yeah, and some of them are horrifying. We're talking about the holidays now. Not everybody is thrilled with the holidays. Half of everyone, if not more, are miserable. They're alone, they're broke, they lost their job, their kids are a mess. I am so aware of that. I almost feel guilty when I say I had a really great Christmas. Most people are not having a really great Christmas. I've had my share of terrible Christmases. 1 year, when my son Nicholas died, Thanksgiving was 2 months later and Christmas was 3 months later. You can imagine that was not happy. I'm tuned into that underbelly of life. Maybe you have an empathy superpower. That's where your characters come from. That is true. And I've had enough hard experiences in my life that I can draw on some of that and relate to it and apply what I've experienced to other people. I hate the idea of other people suffering. Do you ever use your novels to work through things that happen to you? Sometimes I do. I usually find the answers in the books better than I do just sitting around in real life. Who would you be without writing? I'd be dead. I wouldn't know what to do with myself. It was hard enough when life was based on 9 children who are now pretty much grown up, or pretend to be. Suddenly, who are you when you're not a mother 18 hours a day? My life is all wrapped up in writing. Can you walk us through a day in your life? It starts out interestingly because I travel so much between Paris, San Francisco, and New York. I notice more and more I wake up in the morning and say, oh God, where am I? And I look up to see which bed I'm in and I say, okay, I'm in Paris, but that's already a bad sign. I try to be in my office by 8 every day. If I'm in San Francisco, I meet with my staff. If I'm not working on a book, I answer emails, work on an outline, do research. I pretty much stay at my desk all day. I eat at my desk, which I'm sure is very unhealthy and uncivilized. If I am working on a book and haven't had a chance to write that day, I usually start writing around 8 p.m. and go until about 3 a.m. But if I start writing in the morning, whenever that is, I'll start on the book and keep going through the day. I work on average 20 hours a day, sometimes 22, occasionally 24, and then whatever time of day it is, I sleep for 4 hours, then I go back to the book. I think my body is used to it. What do you wear when you work? You definitely have a signature style. I discovered a brand of cashmere nighties. I bought 44 of them because they were going out of business. They have a kangaroo pouch in the front where I can put my cell phone, pins, post-its, all kinds of junk. I tell myself, today I get dressed, but I never do. I admire people who work from home and look cute. I love shopping, but I don't get to shop very often. Not if you're working 24 hours a day, unless you start online shopping, which I'm not very good at. But I have to admit, I check out some of the online shopping things, or Zara. Zara is great fun if it's 4 in the morning and I don't feel like going to bed yet. What's the hardest part about being Danielle Steele? The hardest part is that people don't know who I am. I'm very shy. I grew up alone with my father, and he was not crazy about children. I had to be invisible. That's how I became a writer, by observing everything around me. So people don't really know me, but they have all these preconceived ideas. I walk into a room, and it's like having a billboard over your head. Ugh, it's her. Immediately, you're either shorter or taller or fatter than people imagined. They look at you with a critical eye. Then if you add the prejudice or jealousy, because they assume I have such a cushy life because I've been successful. Or guys are resentful because I'm more successful than they are. Fame is a hat you can't take off. As one of my friends said, you can't be rude at the pantyhose counter anymore. That has made me, in time, much shyer and more selective about my friends. I've never been a giant extrovert, but I used to be out in the world more. Are you dating anyone? Still single. I tell myself that if there were somebody in my life, I'd spend more time not working, but it would take someone who has a certain understanding about my work. I was always married to people who didn't like my work or the fame. I kept it as out of the way as possible. I was always apologizing. That's one thing I hope I've earned. It would be nice to be with someone who thinks what I do is cool and who respects it. I'd like a more even exchange than I've had in the past. I was always with people who were much older and very authoritarian. Now if they're much older, they'd be dead. Is there any upside to fame? My fame and my success have allowed me to have 9 kids. The blessings are material. On the more ephemeral side, it's more of a curse. It's a very hard role, which sounds pathetic. I've been watching season 3 of The Crown, and at one point Prince Philip was complaining about how much money he has. I can't complain about a horrible life. I have a very, very nice life. But it's not easy. Do you get recognized by strangers? Actually, I always laugh at this one. One of my sons was in college. I went to Macy's because he needed sheets. I had a terrible cold, but he needed the sheets right away. This woman came up to me and said, "Are you Danielle Steele?" Sometimes I say no, but I said yes. And she said, "You look like shit." Do you have a dual talent of perseverance and a way with words? Do you think anyone can write a book, or are these skills innate? I think with enough perseverance and discipline, anybody could do it. But they don't want to make the sacrifices. They don't want to give up lunch with friends. A lot of times I look out and it's a beautiful day and I think it would be so cool to go out for a while. But if I go out for a while, I lose the thread of a story. On good days where I don't feel like working, I make myself sit there. That's the deciding factor in anything. Apparently, having a nemesis is trendy at the moment. Do you have a nemesis you compete against? I compete against me. Did I do my best? Did I push my hardest? Did I try my hardest? It's always been competing against me, not other writers. In a way, it's boring to be so diligent about your work, but it brings you great rewards. So, after 179 books, you're still not satisfied? It's 185 books. Oh, so sorry, 185 books. Will you ever be able to rest? I hope not. I can do that when I'm dead. Our next article is titled, 5 Women Get Real About Complicated Mother-Daughter Relationships. What makes the relationship between mother and daughter so fraught, so ferociously loving, so freighted with meaning? Whether you speak daily or she's been dead for 20 years, five women weigh in on the wonders of this singular bond. The long and binding road. It was hard for Jacqueline Michard's adopted daughter to accept her new home, and even harder to accept the woman offering it. I remember exactly where I was when I first saw her face. On a cold fall afternoon, I was sitting on my bed with my laptop, revising a novel, when an email arrived. A friend had sent me a photo of four little girls, all Ethiopian orphans. She hoped to adopt two of them, but it was one of the others, the oldest, who drew my eye. She was the most beautiful human being I'd ever seen. She would likely never be adopted, my friend told me. She would likely be forced to support her little sister, the fourth girl in the photo, by working as a prostitute. She would likely contract AIDS and be dead before age 20. Her dad had died of AIDS, and when her birth mother saw no alternative but to surrender her children for adoption, this girl had threatened to drink bleach. She would never leave her mother, she said. She would never go to America. I tried to put the girl out of my mind, dragging the photo to my computer's trash can, then emptying it. But I could not forget her face. One day, on what I convinced myself was a mere whim, I called the adoption agency. Had anyone adopted the other two girls in the photo? No, I was told. The big sister was the problem. She was difficult. I asked, did she have special needs? No, the social worker said. She was just fierce. My husband and I had enough children, seven to be exact, some biological, some adopted. They ranged in age from Rob, 23, to Atticus, just 3. We'd also recently had a financial catastrophe, hardly a good time to take on more responsibility. Yet I felt such longing for this fierce child. And so 10 months later, on Christmas Day, Merritt and her little sister Marta came home to me. At first, things seemed fine. Merritt was fascinated by snow. She loved her Christmas presents. I was optimistic. I knew cross-cultural adoptions could be complicated, even seen by some as wrong, but I'd done this before. What could be so different? This. Merritt hated me. In the days after her arrival, she grieved with an intensity I'd never before witnessed. She refused to eat anything except bread. All she wanted from me, she let me know, was an education. She told me one night, as we walked to our minivan in a parking lot, that she would never be an American citizen, ever. Honey, I told her, you already are. Merritt turned and kicked the side of the van, denting it. The other kids gasped. I am not your honey, she said. And she was not. At times, I could draw Merritt to me. When I cooked, I would measure the ingredients, and unobserved, she would put them into the pot. She let me take her out to skate on the frozen lake, where she was absolutely unequipped and absolutely fearless. She laced up her skates and fell 40 times. We went together for swimming lessons, and at the pool, she climbed the ladder to the highest diving board and jumped into the deep end, straight down to the bottom, where she stayed until I hauled her up. She clung to me until we reached the edge, then pulled herself out, refusing my help, and walked away. When I read Little Women aloud for the other children, she would listen outside the door. I even took her to Orchard House in Concord, Massachusetts, and showed her the room where Louisa May Alcott wrote. I saw tears in her eyes when I told her the classic was based on the author and her own three sisters. But Merritt denied how moved she was. It's not real, she said. It's a story. On her first birthday in the United States, when she turned 11, we played a game, a family tradition. Each of us expressed a wish for Merritt, then she got to voice a wish for herself. To move to a beautiful, huge city far away from here, she said with a smile. Finally, I realized all I could do was all I could do. Nothing would ever bring us closer. A year passed this way. I think the fight was about my putting butter on her peas. She hates butter. But whatever it was, on a frigid fall evening, Merritt refused to come inside, sitting all night on the trampoline in our backyard, drinking water from the hose, telling the other kids she didn't care whether coyotes ate her. Eventually, I gave up on trying to lure her inside. I woke to find Merritt in the darkness next to my bed. I wondered whether she would hit me. Instead, she said, "Okay, I will take you as my mother." She got into the bed and I held her, and she cried for 3 hours until she fell into a sleep that lasted a night and a day. I have never struggled so mightily for a relationship, not with a lover, nor a husband, not with anyone. We still rarely go a month without a verbal sparring match, and yet, of all my children, Merritt is the one I know without question would risk her life for me. Not long ago, I heard her describe the house she would build when she's grown, with 5 bedrooms. One for her and her husband, one for her daughter, one for her son, one for guests. That's only 4, someone said. Well, one is for Mom, she said. When Mom is an old lady, she will live in my house. For her college essay, she wrote about my struggles to grow a lemon tree indoors. It included the lines, "I am my mother's lemon tree. I thrive where I was not planted." Stronger Together. Chris Krenlidge traveled to the foothills of Georgia and the solace of 19 strangers to grapple with a singularly devastating loss. My mother died of cancer when she was 34 and I was 10. As a young person, I struggled to envision living past the age she was when I lost her. Once I did, I had no idea what to do with myself. Part of me still felt 10 years old, waiting for guidance I would never receive. Mother's Day was the loneliest day of the year, a reminder of what was missing. I refused to celebrate it. For nearly 40 years after her death, I told myself I was fine, and outwardly I was. I'd managed to become a successful, thriving adult, but the kid in me was still suffering, and she didn't know how to make it stop. Grief, unresolved, lurking, popped up at random, inappropriate times. Over the years, I'd feel a little zing in my chest when I saw mothers and daughters shopping or having lunch. When my friends complained about their moms, I couldn't commiserate. In fact, I often grew angry. At least you have a mother to annoy you. I was fascinated by women the age my mother would have been, but hesitant to befriend them. I didn't want to appear too needy to turn them into surrogate moms against their will. Like most people, I cried during Steel Magnolias, but when I couldn't stop bawling at the end of Bad Moms, I knew I had some issues to address. Chief among them was the fear that I'd lost my connection to my mother, the person, rather than my mother, the sick person. When I remembered her, I always pictured her ill and feeble. But in life, she had been positive and upbeat, with a loud laugh and a Texas drawl. She called everyone honey. To me, she looked like a combination of Elizabeth Taylor and Mary Tyler Moore. Tall, with black hair, sparkly hazel eyes, and a huge fuchsia smile. She was proud of her Grecian nose and double D's. She was chubby and couldn't have cared less. She was her college's homecoming queen. She sat on the PTA. She was fearless and people liked her, and I wanted to superimpose that version of her over the invalid who had hijacked my memory. So a few years ago, I attended a motherless daughter's weekend retreat at a spa in Georgia's wine country with 19 other women, all of whom had been 20 or younger when their mothers died. I was intrigued but wary. Growing up, I had learned to not talk about my mother. Doing so made people uncomfortable, I'd found. Also, I'm not great at sharing with strangers, and while I enjoy yoga, which was on the agenda, I worried I'd have to bear all in group discussions, maybe engage in sappy trust falls. What I found instead was a sisterhood. Sitting in a circle in the yoga studio, which had a 180-degree view of the Blue Ridge Mountains, we told our stories. Each was different, but as I listened, I heard themes from my own life. We all felt the same, stuck, frozen at the age we'd been when our mothers died. We all had a fear of dying young, and once we didn't, a sense that we lacked a path forward. We had difficulty connecting with loved ones, because what if they died too? I wasn't the only one who always hated celebrating her own birthday, who hid in her room when she got her first period, who waffled on marrying her longtime boyfriend, who squirmed when someone called her a woman because she felt like a child. We all dreaded Mother's Day. We were asked to remember anecdotes about our mothers and then use them to introduce our moms to each other. The details of our relationship, of who she had been, came flooding back. I told the group how my mother bought me my first Nancy Drew book in an Albertsons grocery store, and how I've loved mysteries ever since. One woman's mother enrolled her in dance classes and hoped she'd become a rockette. Another mom sent multiple gifts with her daughter to birthday parties so siblings weren't left out. Since we were of varying ages and circumstances when our mothers died, some relationships were more complex. A few had been teens, and they remembered conflicts they'd had with their mothers, while others were too young to form concrete memories at all. I felt grateful for my kind, sunny mother. I felt even more grateful to be able to remember so much of her. In one exercise, we were asked to hold up our mother's photo and say our name and also hers. I wasn't prepared for this. I hadn't said my mother's name in years. As my turn neared, my heart thudded in my ears. I didn't know whether I could get the words out, but I did. I said, "I'm Chris, daughter of Penny." Speaking of her this way made her a person again, not a memory or an illness or a taboo subject that made others feel awkward. I began to cry, and looking around the room, I saw that everyone else was crying too. Before heading home, we discussed goal setting, self-care, staying in touch. We did a cinnamon roll hug, everyone standing in a line, holding hands, and then starting at one end, spiraling into each other. Group hugs are not exactly my thing, but this was nice because these women were now my friends. There's no getting over this kind of loss, but I've been given tools, a community, a path back to the vibrant version of my mother, to whom no grief is attached. Not long after the retreat, I celebrated Mother's Day for the first time, and I've celebrated it ever since. Pump up the volume. Molly Guy teaches her daughter the art and the necessity of sounding off. Recently, I chaperoned a field trip with my daughter's first grade class. On the school bus, the girl sitting beside my child began berating her. She called her a copycat, alleging that my daughter had sneaked a peek at her worksheet. In response, my daughter looked out the window and cried, hard. You should know a few things. One, she's not a crier. Two, the girl just sat there, smug as a snake, and never said sorry. Three, I did not intervene. I thought if I did, it would make my kid look like a wimp. I know why she was crying. My daughter prides herself on doing the right thing. Being accused of breaking a rule freaks her out to the bone, so her body reacted, not her brain. It was too much for her mind to bear. At dinner that night, I said, I know it sucks to be called a copycat, but if someone yells at you for something you didn't do, try to get brave. Breathe in slowly, make your chest big like a lion's. Use your bold voice. Tell the girl, that's not true. I don't like when you talk to me like that. She climbed into my lap. She was listening. What happened on the bus was a small thing, but small things can become big things. Growing up, when I went to Supercuts and the hairdresser put the dryer on high, burning my scalp, I never said, please turn that off. I was worried I'd hurt her feelings. In eighth grade, I got my period all over my jean shorts while my dad drove me to tennis camp. Instead of asking him to pull over so I could change, which required saying something uncomfortable, I showed up at orientation looking like I'd partaken in a massacre. In college, I had one-night stands in which the sex was bad, rough, painfully so. As writhing frat boys left marks on my body with their hands, I pretended I was having fun. I was a girl who kept quiet at all costs. It takes a long time to unlearn that. I don't want my daughter to go through life with sealed lips when something hurts. I don't want her to turn inward when her integrity is on the line. The next time someone tells my daughter, you're doing it wrong, I hope she looks that person in the eye and says, I'm doing it the way I want to do it. The next time someone hurts her feelings, I hope she says, you hurt my feelings, and walks away. I hope she says it loudly. I hope she says what she needs to. I hope she says what I didn't. The double-edged mother. She could be cruel and thoughtless, or magnetic and loving. Now that her mom is gone, Amanda Abutu chooses which version to remember. If I ever wondered what my mom wanted for Mother's Day, all I had to do was visit the fridge and look at the list written in her exquisite cursive she made for us kids. The first item, L'Air du Temps, or for those of us who couldn't read yet, a glossy photo of the perfume cut from a magazine. She was all want, my mother, particularly when it came to attention. For that, her hunger was insatiable. There were four of us kids, plus my dad. If one didn't give her what she desired, she'd move on to the next. If it was your turn, she'd whisper in your ear while everyone was sleeping, come on, let's go get some coffee. And you'd know she meant eggs and Taylor ham at the diner, and that there you'd hear some small revelatory detail about her life that she'd entrust to you and only you. In that moment, nothing else existed. Not the time she slammed you into the wall for eating leftover Chinese food in their air-conditioned bedroom, the house's only air-conditioned room, because you knew she was on a diet and the smell made her hungry. Not the time she forgot about pickup and left you at school for hours. Not the time she swore you weren't invited to that birthday party because you now suspect she just didn't feel like taking you. None of it mattered. She had chosen you, and you were magnificent. For years, I tried to address these injuries, the college financial aid form she never filled out, the high tea bridal shower she insisted on planning, during which she consoled me because she hadn't invited any of my friends, but that was impossible. Either she didn't remember these events or wouldn't allow herself to. It was like arguing with an amnesiac. The solution, it turned out, was death. At 59, my mother suffered a massive heart attack and died several weeks later. I left the hospital one night and she still existed. I fell asleep, woke to a telephone call in my darkened bedroom, and learned she no longer did. On a rainy September day, we gathered to bury the mom who had hurt me repeatedly, deeply, forgetfully. That was when my own amnesia began to lift. I remembered good things, not just the bad. I remembered the mom who taught me to add a pat of butter to tomato sauce, who befriended every waiter who served her, who made a pros and cons list with me when I was deciding which job to take after college, who invited lonely strangers to our Thanksgiving dinners. This was the mom who put a map on our wall when I drove across the country and used colored thumbtacks to track my route, accepting my collect calls the whole way. The mom who could make me believe I was wondrous because she was looking at me, smiling, offering me an adventure. This is the mom I chose to save. In one memory, it's dark out. I have homework. I know the gas is expensive. Let's go for a drive, she says, her antidote to any pain, this time mine. She backs out of the driveway and onto the main road, throws the car into drive, cranks up Space Oddity. Soon, instead of houses, there are trees, then only blackness. My mom and I are hurtling through space singing. I loved her then with wild abandon, with no hurting or wanting between us. Now every time I belt out Magic Man like she did or befriend my waiters, I'm choosing the best version of my mom. I conjure the best grandmother for my children. I make her magnificent. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.